Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Friday Night Dharmaloka of the Society. Tonight we have Ajahn Brahm back for his last time in 3 months, and we also have Venerable Medito on the right and Venerable Bodhi Ji on the left. A few announcements tonight as we go into a bit of a quiet period for the Society, so if you just bear with me. First of all, we can all move forward a little bit if we want, because with the new cameras, the video cameras for live streaming, the angles are different, and we can sit sort of within, let's say, 2 metres. Is that all right, Ajahn Brahm?
Wow.
2 metres of Ajahn Brahm. So we'll try and from now on a little bit. Okay. First of all, a car has left its lights on, and Ian in the crowd, you've got its, Ian, what's the car? Your lights are on. So we have the entry to the range retreat at Bodhinyana on Sunday, and this is where the monks have 3 months off, and they don't leave the monastery. And last week we had the ceremony for the nuns up at Dharmasara, and it was a great day. I took my old mum up there for a country drive, and she loved it. And the nuns did some really good chanting. It was a good day.
Did you leave your mum there?
she'll ordain next lifetime.
Okay.
She's not quite a Buddhist yet. She's almost there. I'll keep at it. So on Sunday, it's a 9:30 a.m. start. Ajahn Brahm will be conducting the letting go ceremony. So this is where you walk up to the donation box and you let go of notes and coins as they hit the bottom.
I told you that one. Very good.
On Sunday, ceremony, so it'll run roughly from 10 till 12. After that time, you're welcome to do a tour of the monastery and see how the monks live and have a look at their cooties. And in particular, Ajahn Brahm's meditation cave will be open.
Yes. You see why I meditate all the time? And you go and sit in there, and it's so calm and so powerful.
But everyone's got to be out by 1 o'clock,
because he's got some
meditating to do. And if anyone lives between Hammersley Kareen and a straight line to Serpentine, and they want to lift down on Sunday, come and see me afterwards. I've got some spots in my car. So there'll be no dana on Sunday because the monks will be at Bodhinyana. There'll be no dana on the weekends, that is offerings, food offerings to the monks in the next hall. That all ceases until October when the monks come out. So for the ceremony on Sunday, Prem, are you here, Prem? You can stand up. There he is. Prem's at the back. So he's on the committee. He's our volunteers coordinator. He needs about 20 volunteers to turn up at Bodhinyana at 8 o'clock. He's got about 10 people so far. So these volunteers, just for a couple of hours to help with the parking and laying out the tables and other bits and pieces. So if you'd like to volunteer, just rock up at the monastery at 8 o'clock at the Dana Hall, and Prem will be there with his other volunteers, and you can give a helping hand and earn some good karma. What else? Okay, so once the monks enter the monastery on Sunday, we then run a guest speaker program for the next 3 months on Friday nights, and we have a variety of lay people and some monastics from other traditions. And this year, Hugh and Ruth are organising it, and I had a look at the program, and it looks really good. It starts off next week with our very own Vice President, Chris Perrier, up the front here, and he'll be running it. Chris is a clinical psychologist, and he'll be running a session on, I imagine, Chris, to do with psychology and Buddhism.
Actually, the session, actually, it's not going to be a talk, so it won't be like a normal Dharma talk that you get from Ajahn Brahm. But it will be more a question and answer session and some practical exercises. The focus is on two sayings of the Buddha, and the monks are much more eloquent and be able to quote the chapter and verse on this. But the two sayings are that I can think of no one more worthy of loving kindness in the world or in the universe than oneself. That's one saying of the Buddha. And the other one is, you know, in life you cannot cover the world with leather so that you don't hurt yourself, but you can cover your shoes or your feet with leather so you can walk through the world unscathed. And so I thought I'd give a talk on a talk and a series of exercises on the Brahmaviharas, particularly compassion, and how that relates to emotional resilience and when you get knocked down in life, how to get back up from it. So this is going to be a batch of, we'll do a simple meditation that won't be very long, and then we'll do about four or five different little exercises which will actually be very thought-provoking in helping you to identify inner resources to help you develop and make more meaningful and more powerful your experiences of the Brahmaviharas. So often when you talk about these things, you get the ideas, and even when you come to Dharma talks, and you know, you might hear a great Dharma talk from Ajahn Brahm, but does it stick? My talk next week will show you some nuts and bolts strategies to make the good Dharma talks and the knowledge of the Buddha stick in terms of how you can stick it in your nervous system. Because so often when you are listening to good talks and Dharma talks and these sorts of things, it's like water that just flows over concrete. It doesn't sink in. And this will be offering some useful strategies to how to make these pearls of wisdom from the Buddha sink in deeper into your bones and use them in your practical life. So that's what we'll do. It'll be exercises and a strong series of question and answers. So that's what's up for next week. Please bring your brains along with you, okay, to use them in the exercises. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris. And we have a variety of speakers. We've got someone from the Sikh temple is coming. You can check the program on the web or on the board inside. We've got, for the first time, an Aboriginal spiritual elder is coming, and he'll be giving a talk. 12th of August, we've got Rob Gordon from Board Accord. He's doing Dharma and Corporate Disruption. It's a really good program, so pick and choose what suits you and check it out on the board. And that's about it. So without much further ado, I'll wrap up and hand over to Ajahn Brahm for the meditation and Dharma talk. Thank you.
Very good. So now is the time to let the water run off the concrete of your mind. All the past and the future and all those thoughts that disappears to empty out. So a few people have got empty minds anyway. That's my sometimes my teachers used to tell me that. There's nothing in there, is there? I said, yes, thank you for appreciating my great wisdom. So we're not trying to gain things, we're trying to empty out. We're trying to see how we can be free and light and peaceful. So to do that, we close our eyes and empty our mind of all this sight, seeing people, seeing colours, seeing things. So at least we can empty our minds of all the visual clutter of our lives. And then we sit down in our posture, and as I say every week, the first thing we do is to check how we are sitting, just little area by area. I usually start by checking my bottom first of all. Is it sitting comfortably on the cushion? Or if you've got a fat bottom like me, you don't need cushions sometimes. You've got your own upholstery, which is very handy if you have to travel around as much as I do. And then just check though, is your bottom comfortable on its seat? Do you need to move, adjust? Because sometimes a tiny adjustment means you're going to be pain-free and comfortable for the rest of the meditation. So be mindful, be aware of your physical posture, starting off with the bottom. And then you check your legs. How are your legs folded or bent over the chair? Are they in such a position you can maintain that comfort for the 30 minutes of the meditation period? Or will you need to move? So I'm asking you to be mindful of how you have your legs positioned. And if necessary, move them. And to see if the mindfulness tells you that the position has improved in comfort. In meditation, we don't just endure. We just find out how to relieve our body first of all, in proper postures, not by being told what's the best, but by feeling it with your mindfulness. How does your legs feel? Can it be improved? If so, do so. And that is a combination of mindfulness and kindness, working hand in hand. And then I go to my back to make sure that's comfortable. I just focus on all the feelings and sensations in my back, checking that it's not too tight, not too loose, that it's well supported, not too far to the left, too far to the right. Then I look at my arms and hands to make sure they're comfortable too. And then look at your head, balanced on top of your neck, making sure not too far to the left or the right. And I like to just focus on the muscles around my eyes and mouth. And see if I can relax them. It's a very simple exercise in mindfulness and the feedback which you get, which teaches you how to relax muscles around the eyes and the mouth. You can feel the sensations change. You can feel the eyes relaxing and the mouth loosening and the forehead relaxing too. It is a little method of using mindfulness to give you feedback so you know how to relax. And that same thing which you use to relax the muscles around the eyes and the mouth and letting go is what you use to go into deeper relaxation. Every week when I sit here, there's always one part of my body which is irritating. This time of the year it's usually the throat. Other times it might be the stomach, could be the knees. So can you feel that part of the body which is most irritating at this moment? And focus in on that. Zoom in on the most irritating part of your body. So your mindfulness is totally concerned with that one part of the body which needs some attention, because it's irritating, it's painful, it's aching. When I focus in, I can do a little bit of letting go. I often imagine that in this case my throat is like it's being pulled. There's a rope and two people on either end are pulling it tight. And I imagine that those two people let go. And the string becomes loose. And my throat relaxes. The muscles, the tension, lessens because I let go. So whatever part of the body is irritating or aching, be aware of it. Notice how those feelings change until you learn, often just by trial and error, how to ease those feelings. The mindfulness will show you if they're getting more intense. The mindfulness will show you if they're getting more at ease. You're getting feedback. And you soon work out what you need to do to ease those feelings, and what you should avoid, which always makes those feelings more intense or more of a problem. You learn from the feedback given by awareness. Keep focusing on the irritating feeling until it eases off so much that it's not a problem anymore. And then your mindfulness can go to another part of the body which needs some help. Just a week or two ago, I had the Cancer Support Association, or Wellness Association they call themselves now, at Bodhinyana Monastery. And I could teach them this method, so they could focus on that part of the body which had the tumour and relax it to the max to bring health to their body. Because when the body's relaxed, energies flow freely. So once one part is relaxed, I go to another part. Zoom in again on an irritating feeling. Know it as fully as I can. Observe that feeling increase, decrease in intensity. And learn why. I learn how to relax my own body very, very deeply. I do this at the beginning of the meditation, so my posture is really strong. And also, for the exercise in mindfulness and letting go, relaxing. When my body is ready, relax. Then I can start to relax my mind. Not resisting anything. Just letting things be. I often imagine my mother. Mm-hmm. So there's usually a bit of movement. Some coming in, some going out. Very good. So, for this evening's talk, I did. Somebody gave me an interesting article about empathy a few days ago, and I thought that'd be a lovely subject for this talk, because empathy can be very useful, but it's also one of the causes of many of the problems in our modern world. Simply because empathy, like feeling other people, how their emotions, tuning into them, understanding how other people are feeling. Most of the time, we only tune in to other people's negative feelings. That when they're having a hard time, that we tend to have a hard time. It's so sad. Oh, it's so awful. It's so terrible. And people keep on ringing me up and saying, have you heard about the latest crisis? The latest disaster? The latest Britain has left European Union? Where? There's another, the free map of Dockers have lost again. Ah! And sometimes these are big things, like the, apparently a terrorist attack this morning in France somewhere. Ah! And so sometimes we live in a culture which, if we don't have empathy, we're considered to be callous, almost inhuman. But if we do have empathy, that sometimes it's so out of control that we suffer when we shouldn't really be suffering at all. We get worried and concerned about other people's pain. Too much so. I must admit that I first saw this many years ago, on another retreat, many years ago, every time, full moon of July to the full moon of October, we do our annual 3 month retreat. I call it a rest period, by which I mean the rest of the monks have a wonderful time. I have to teach them all for 3 months. So I don't have much rest except for 2 weeks when I hide in my cave and don't come out. So we all have a little bit of a retreat. So I was doing my 15-day retreat in my cave. And when I came out, I didn't know what had been going on in the world. And all these people, the visitors, even some of the monks were so sad. So what's happened? Did one of the monks die? Did the hall burn down? Was there a disaster? What happened? Why are you so sad? And it was because Princess Diana had died. I couldn't believe it. Were you related? Did you know her? Did she owe you some money? Why are you so upset? And it was like empathy gone mad. That everybody was feeling sadness and sorrow, tuning in to an emotion which really had nothing to do with them. And they were celebrating that emotion. Now you may say, well, fair enough that she was a leading figure and she inspired some people, but is that really an appropriate response to tragedies? Just to actually to feel the pain of others? Because what happens in our modern world, there are so many tragedies and disappointments and things which go wrong, which we either see on the newscasts or in the newspapers, or we hear by word of mouth, or we see in our job, we see in our family. There's so many people have far too much empathy, they tend to get very negative and depressed. Too often people say, the world is going wrong, there's a financial crisis coming, there's Islamic revolution, it's going to come to Perth next, the whole world is falling apart. What are you talking about? I haven't seen any bombs go off in my monastery in Serpentine. I haven't seen economic crisis in the Buddhist Society of Western Australia.
I haven't seen too many problems. I've seen a lot of happiness. Yeah, people have their problems. But there's also another part of life. Why is it we always like to focus on the problems of life and never actually see the real picture, the bigger picture, which is way, way bigger than the problems of our world? Why is it? Again, I've been in these cities sometimes. I remember being in Penang when the tsunami struck. I never saw any tsunami. You had to be just in the right place at the right time to actually to see it. Some people were in Kuala Lumpur when they had the riots there years ago. And apparently they told me they got phone calls from their relations. Are you okay? Are you okay? I said, well, what are you talking about? We're just having quiet dinner in a restaurant. But there's riots there. Because such a huge city, there's only riots in a couple of streets. You had to be in the wrong street at the wrong time to be able to be caught up in that sort of stuff. But the way people thought about it, they get so caught up in negativity. They feel that the problem is going much wider and deeper than it really is. There's something about our human race where empathy was a useful character trait so we could actually feel each other's emotions and communicate and help each other with care and compassion, because so too much that sometimes we feel other people's pain far too much. And instead, where we could be a rock of stability, a person who's actually standing there without feeling sort of sadness, so that people can emphasize with the positive side of life as well, instead of always emphasizing in the negative, empathizing with the negative part of life. We do have a choice. And I've seen that so often, especially like, you know, talking about Princess Diana with funerals. I've seen so often that, you know, when I have had the privilege to perform a funeral service, that people come in to that funeral service and they're expecting sadness. And because they expect sadness, this human quality of empathy, they just feed on each other's people's sadness, and they all get sad, they all get start crying. It was actually the same the same phenomenon which I've seen so often, because I travel in aircraft so much in my life. If you are in economy class and there's many mothers with their children, have you ever noticed when one starts crying, they all start crying? And it's chaos and pandemonium. He's trying to meditate and rah, rah, rah. Not just one kid you can manage, but when it's a six or seven. Why do they all start crying at the same time? It's like empathy gone bizarre. One person, one kid is crying. They've probably got a good reason for it. And the other kids pick up on that. And they think they should start crying as well. And that just causes so much suffering and loud noise sort of in the aircraft. I often thought that wouldn't it be wonderful if aircraft could have just a little cabin in the back there, you know, just with soundproof, so they can put all the... They've got a place for baggage. They've got a place for first class. Can't we just find a little place in the back for the babies who are crying? Anyway, that's cruel, I know, but sometimes I'm sure you felt like that as well. If you've been on a long flight trying to go to sleep at night and a baby starts crying, and they all start. But that whole phenomena of like one kid crying, another person starts crying, now you sort of start to apply that to grown-ups, you. When one person is sad at a funeral, why do other people start to feel sad at funerals? Why? It's exactly the same phenomena. It's empathy gone crazy, when really it has no benefit to anybody. It's one of the reasons why I refuse to get sad at funerals. In my mother's own funeral, I would not get sad, because I wanted to be somebody who showed an alternative so they could empathize with the people who are feeling sad, or they could empathize with me, who wasn't sad, to give them a choice so that they could actually have a funeral service which wasn't always so sad and miserable and depressing. It's, you know, it's a little bit better these days. When I first started doing funeral services here in Perth, people were always in black. Okay, now at least some people have white. But I want funeral directors to start wearing Hawaiian shirts. And nice dresses or nice clothes. Not all this miserable stuff, which actually makes people more and more depressed. because, oh, crikey, just, I've seen kids, and kids are great teachers for me, children come into these funerals, playing around, being naughty like children should be. And they're full of life and joy and happiness. And then they see everybody else just black, wearing black, and their faces look sort of black as well. And these little kids full of life, you can see just the joy of life just go out of them. And they learn from watching their parents, the empathy of sadness. So they too are sad at the funerals. Why do people do that? For me, the funerals have been a lot of fun in my life. Some of my best funerals I've ever been to. There was many funerals, especially when something goes wrong. They're always the best funerals. There was one time, a Chinese family, the father died or grandfather died. And you know what it is, keeping up with, not with the Joneses, keeping up with the Wongs, that their casket, their coffin had so many things on the outside, handles and baubles and stuff. And okay, fair enough, if you want to sort of show how much you love your father by putting so much stuff and get the most expensive coffin in the range, fair enough. But unfortunately, they put so much stuff on the outside of the coffin that when they started lowering it down the hole, it got stuck halfway. It got jammed. And they couldn't pull it up, and they couldn't push it down. And it would stand halfway, and all the time I was doing this chanting, and I was chanting for about 10 or 15 minutes before they managed to free it. I was going hoarse. And the other time, one other favourite sort of favourite story, was when, again a similar one, this was in Fremantle Cemetery, where it's my fault really, because I knew a few things about funerals. You don't have to have the ordinary coffins, you can make your own coffin. And when I told this to this person, you know, he was like into sort of sports, and they made it in the form of a boat, because he loved going in boats. So, you know, they had to get a certain size, so they made it out of jarrah wood, which is incredibly heavy. That was a big mistake. Because as soon as they put it on the conveyor belt to take it, you know, through this sliding glass panel, it was so heavy, the motor which was supposed to run the conveyor was struggling so much it couldn't actually push it properly. But it pushed it enough to go halfway through before the glass panel slammed against it, and again, it was stuck. Stuck halfway, halfway in, halfway out. And I always remember the look on the funeral director's face. It went ashen, because that's the worst thing in their life if something goes wrong at a funeral service. And I always remember, she comes here, the wife, the widow, Jenny. You know what she did? She jumped up on the conveyor belt and tried to push it in. And people were saying, "You trying to get rid of your husband that badly?" Trying to push it through. And at that point, everybody started cracking up laughing. It shamed the whole empathy of the whole thing. Somebody else once also said, I always remember this, they said, "Yeah, that's typical of this guy. The first day when he was a young man, the first day in his car, he crashed his car. The first day in his coffin, he crashes his coffin as well." Now that took all the negativity out of a funeral and made it sort of amusing. It changed the empathy. We were now empathizing not with the sadness of the death, but of the joy of a life, remembering all these interesting things which he did in his life. And that is what I love to do whenever there is anything negative, always trying to find a positive side in it. Even I think I was telling the monks this story, because, you know, monks come from many different backgrounds, and it's one of my friends, he's a monk over in Sydney. And how he had a really interesting life. He was from Balmain. He wrote a little book. I hope it's in the library here. It's well worth reading. And from Balmain to Buddha, he called it. And he had one of the classic opening lines of his little book. And he said, "I was born in Balmain," which was the dock city in those days, the very poorest part of Sydney. And he said, "If you still had your two front teeth by the time you were four, it meant you were a girl." They'd always punch them out. He's a tough guy. But anyway, before he became a monk, he got a job as a funeral director. And he told me all the interesting stuff which can happen actually as a funeral director. Like, for example, taking the coffin to the wrong cemetery. It does happen. Or putting, you know, sometimes you have to collect the bodies, you know, from, you know, people who died, and sometimes instead of just collecting one body, you know, put two or three in the back, and it just happened these two or three people were very, very overweight, and so when they put the third coffin in the back, sort of the back of the car was scraping on the ground, it was so heavy. Or the most fascinating one he once told me, he said that it was in one of these small apartment blocks, you know, they all call them flats in Sydney, old flats. And there was an old gentleman who died on the top story. And these were in those days where people would have been living in these apartment blocks, these flats, for years and years. Everybody knew everybody. And it was so old and narrow, there's no way they could get, you know, putting the corpse on a little stretcher. No way they can get it down the stairs. The stairs were far too narrow. And even the elevator was such a small elevator, they couldn't lay it down on the ground. So they thought the only way to do it was actually take this dead body with these two undertakers in black on either side, vertical, holding it in the elevator. So you can picture it in the elevator, two men in black on either side and this dead person in the middle, vertical. And had to go from the top story down maybe six or seven floors. And they were just praying, please, may no one press the button and interrupt us halfway down. But of course, you know, there's something which is Murphy's Law. If it can happen, it does happen, of course. Halfway down, the lift stopped, and the doors open, and there's this little old lady on the other side. And you can imagine what she saw. This guy, she knew he was dead. She lived in the apartment, standing between two guys in black, and they said they don't know how this happened. They lost control of the body, and the body started falling towards her. And the poor lady fainted. Fell to the ground. They thought they might have another customer. The only thing they could do was like, hold him back up again, and push the button. They had to go down and they just hoped for the best. And of course, as soon as they got this, the old dead guy into the back of the car, they went back up again and just, fortunately, the old girl was okay. But, you know, imagine that shock, that really ruined her day. But now what that's actually doing to you, reason I tell you those stories, is because it's taking away one perception, putting another perception in. And sometimes the empathy is just too much onto the sad stuff. Always feeling people's pain. Well, why can't we feel people's happiness? Why can't we feel the funny side of life instead of always just the negative side of life? Why don't we keep on saying, oh, isn't it terrible, isn't it terrible, isn't it terrible? Why do we focus on that? Why can't we focus on another part? And that's one of my jobs, to get you to have another focus. Empathy. Why is it always feeling people when they're suffering? Because what happens is we do too much of that, but sometimes we have to, actually, especially in a position like myself, you know, as a monk, as a teacher, a counselor, or for you, like as a friend. When someone's in a bad mood, they're really in trouble, sometimes you have to feel how they feel. But don't do that all the time. Feel the happiness as well, because you need to sort of get your energies up. But if you do feel their sadness, because I've, you know, been with people who have gone really through hell, sort of things which I probably wouldn't survive. And, you know, you talk to them and they tell you what happened. And sometimes you have to empathize with them. You have to feel their pain as much as you possibly can. I know maybe some psychologists will say this is dangerous. And it is dangerous. You have to know what you're doing. And I always say that to actually understand how a person is, so you can even give them some compassion, you have to, they're like in a pit, in a well. You have to climb down into that well where they are to feel what they are. Otherwise, you just can't understand who they are, what they're doing, and how they're feeling. You can't really help. I always say you've got to go right down the bottom of that well to be able to hold their hand, to be able to reach them. But it's dangerous because you can get stuck down that well yourself. So, if you go into the well to help a friend or a loved one who's really in pain and suffering, you must always take a ladder. don't forget the ladder. Otherwise, you're stuck down there as well. And when you get that ladder, then you can hold her hand, and the both of you can climb out. But without the ladder, you empathize without enough wisdom and compassion, and then you also become another problem. And that's one of the difficulties in this life. People were telling me that, say, in caring professions, like nurses, like doctors, sometimes you empathize so much, and you see such pain and suffering, it really, really makes you sort of negative. It's one of the reasons why people have negativity, why they have anger, why there are terrorist attacks. Because people who perpetrate these are empathizing just with the pain of maybe their brothers or their friends who they feel have been really maltreated. And when you only empathize with the negativity, with the deep pain, of course that causes either depression or just rage and anger. And you may be able to see that, as I was saying, like in a work situation, like a hospital with nurses. Why do really good people argue with each other and get angry at each other? Because they've been empathizing, you know, with these people who are suffering terrible diseases, great discomfort, even dying, talking to their relations and loved ones. There's not much hope. The people are in pain and nothing you can do. Empathizing so much that you get negative. And that negativity causes, for some people, is anger and violence. And you take it out on people you should never take it out on. The people you work with, the people you love, in your home, in this case, your fellow citizens of this world. Where does that violence come from? And I think it's, one of it is empathy gone wrong. Only one, of course. And so in order to actually to use empathy, but not be controlled by it, you know, we need to have a different way of understanding the way our mind works. Yeah, empathy is good, but keep that ladder there. If you get stuck down there, then you become an angry person, a negative person. And that will be terrible for your health, and terrible for your relationships, terrible for other people as well. Another part of the problem. So what we can do is remember empathy also has to go towards you as well. And the positive empathy as well. Because also people get angry at themselves. The same, but this is actually instead of with other people you work with, you see your own pain, your own difficulties, your own troubles in life. And we just, you know, get very negative and sometimes angry. We're actually feeling the pain of our past. It's like, instead of empathizing with somebody who's really suffering right in front of you in a hospital bed, or a friend who's lost their job and can't find a job and is really having a very difficult time, instead of empathizing with them, sometimes we empathize the same emotion to some of the things we have gone through in the past. That person in front of you suffering is now that person you were in the past, and you sometimes get very angry at that. So, obviously, you know, these things happen, we have to deal with it, but for goodness sake, can we not just use empathy in a positive sense as well? Empathy in a positive sense, empathize with some of the positive emotions which you've had. And also, if you are going through the negative emotions, please, empathy is an emotion, must always be balanced with wisdom. Sometimes empathy is a type of compassion, and compassion also has to be going on with wisdom. Yeah, it's great to be compassionate to other people, but without wisdom, it drags you down. What I mean with wisdom is, oh, I had a difficult week last week at monastery. Many people think, oh, it's so peaceful in a monastery. Lots of nice holy monks to live with. Lots of nice people, no problems. There's always problems and difficulties, and people cut down trees when other people don't want the trees to be cut down. And there are people who get sick, and there's people who spend too much money, and there are all the problems which as a boss you have to deal with. And just like, actually, it's not really a good simile. In the old days, it's always the cream which floats to the top. But it's not the cream, it's all the rubbish which floats on the top in an organization, because that's what the boss has to deal with all the time, especially in the monastery. So I was having a very difficult time a few days ago, and one of actually the people there saying, Ajahn Brahm, you forgot your exercises in the morning. I said, what do you mean? I forgot my exercise. Your push-ups. I wasn't smiling. And they reminded me, now if you don't know the push-ups, this is exercise. Even as a monk, I do exercises every morning. I do push-ups. 10 push-ups. In front of the mirror. 1, 2, 3, 4. Exercise my smiley muscles. Now that's as important as doing other push-ups and other exercise. You can have a healthy body without having a healthy, happy mind. What's the point? So, I do my 10 push-ups, but I forgot because I was miserable. I was just overburdened by just all the problems and difficulties in monastery because I was empathizing with the problems too much. So number one is, look, come on. Problems are part of life. And in fact, the problem with the problem was actually trying to push it away and trying to solve it. Problems aren't there to be solved. They're there to be embraced, learned from. The biggest misunderstanding. Why do you want to solve a problem? Problems are great. If I didn't have all those problems in the monastery, if I didn't have all those problems in my life, I wouldn't learn so much, I wouldn't grow so much. At school, your teachers are always giving you problems. Because that's part of the training, that's part we learn. And that's going to happen after you graduate from school or university. You're always going to have problems. In a relationship, you've got problems. Yeah, we've got problems as well. Has never occurred to you, all relations have got problems. All relationships have got problems. It's par for the course. So instead of trying to get rid of problems, we try and accept them. This is going back to an old teaching of mine, which is powerful. And it's mentioned earlier that somebody was coming up to me and said, oh, I'm just fed up, just trying to be mindful and observe myself, trying to make myself better. And I said, what are you doing? You're not supposed to be making yourself better to improve yourself. If any of you are coming here to improve yourself, you're wasting time. You don't have to improve yourself. You are good enough. And I told this woman, I ban you from improving yourself. You are prohibited from improving yourself. What do you want to do? Who told you not good enough? You're not trying to cure yourself of your bad habits. Instead, you're supposed to care for yourself. This is that old story of this doctor, who he's a gastroenterologist. Over here, he's a specialist now over in Perth, and he probably will listen to this later on YouTube. He knows who I'm talking about. But this was a young doctor I'd known ever since he was really small. His parents brought him up here, and he was first year as a registrar, I think it was, or something. And one of his patients died. It was one of those tragedies. A young woman, 23, 24. Died, his patient. He felt so bad about this, especially when he had to be the one to tell the wife, tell the husband, and to tell the children. Tell the husband, his young wife, 23, 24, still madly in love with each other, had passed away, and that his children had no more mother. And that hurt him so much. So much, he came and said, I can't do this ever again. I can't. It's too painful. And I feel so guilty, I've let this whole family down. And he said, I'm going to have to resign and look for another career. All those years of training and hard work, now he was a qualified doctor, and he's going to throw it all away because of this terrible trauma he felt. And that's actually where I turned him around. And I told him, I said, look, you've misunderstood the purpose of being a doctor. The purpose of being a doctor is not to cure people. If you think that's what you're there for, you're going to fail many, many times. You're not going to be able to cure people. Some people are going to die. but you can always care for them. So that's your main purpose, being a doctor, to care for your patients. Cure is number two. Number one is to care. And you never need to fail as a doctor if you care for the people underneath you. He got it straight away. And so from that day on, he never tried to cure people. He just tried to care for them. And many more people got cured. Could you understand? If you try and cure somebody, sometimes it can be so invasive, so unpleasant, they die. But if you care for them, even if they're dying, care for them, very often that just love, that care gives them enough energy inside of themselves to push through those diseases or sicknesses. Care is so much more important than cure. And so he went around telling other doctors that, so he's obviously been very successful in his career. But also I use that for all other parts of life. Your job in coming here is not to cure yourself, not to improve yourself, not to make yourself a better human being. If you're doing that, you always feel a failure. And it's so hard trying to improve yourself. You're coming here to learn how to care for yourself and care for each other. And if you think you have to cure your husband, you're going to get so frustrated. If you think you're going to try and cure your wife of her bad habits, yeah, dream on. But you can always care for each other. And the same with yourself. Don't try and cure yourself. Care for yourself. And that's what I mean, is actually, instead of curing the bad things, which is what empathy often tries to do. See, all the problems in the world, it's a problem. We try and cure the problems, solve the problems. Don't try and solve the problems. Care for them. Care for the problems, don't cure them. Total different attitude, which means the empathy goes in a totally different direction. Now we care, don't try and cure and solve the problems. And we value the problems, they're part of our life. So when people do die, this is, we embrace this. It's not that something has gone wrong. A terrorist attack in France, something has gone wrong. When people think like that, it's going to go wrong again and again and again. And many people are looking for someone to blame. And it just gets worse and worse and worse. So instead, we care for problems. We don't try to cure them. And then we find the empathy goes in a different way. When we get the empathy and feel all those people right now, in France, suffering incredible pain. You know, imagine just losing, you know, just going out for the night, enjoying yourself. And then you get the message that your young son has been blown apart by some terrorist bomb. What do we do? And why do we do that? So often, you know, it's, sometimes it was a natural. Now, I sometimes question this. How much is a natural response and how much is a culturally embedded response, a culturally learned response? And I say this because I was in northeast Thailand for 9 years, and this was a great experience because this was an indigenous culture. Sometimes we don't think of Asians as indigenous cultures, but indigenous, this culture had not been affected by any other culture over hundreds of years. Settled in that area on the Mekong Delta, it's Mekong River, the upper reaches of the Mekong River, and no foreign people had been up there. And I often say, absolutely true, I went into some of those villages, I was the first white man they'd ever seen, ever. They never had anybody up there who had a white skin before. And so this was indigenous culture. One of the things which was weird, which I noticed living there for 9 years, that people had no grief. That when somebody died, they didn't cry. And for me, a Western, that was just so strange. And it wasn't just one, hundreds of funerals, either conducted or chanted at, witnessed, never saw anybody crying. And it wasn't just at the funeral service, you saw them the day before, because the Buddhist ceremonies there, as soon as they die, you go there the night before, do some chanting, usually to try and drive the ghosts away. And then the following day, they'd have the funeral, and then that evening you go to the house to chant to get the ghosts away as well. So you saw these people, and they're part of the village. You see them the next day on alms round, you see them the day afterwards as well. You never saw any sadness. They were told, no grief. And to me that was shocking. Because what they had is a different way of looking at life, which had been culturally embedded. And, you know, people say these days, okay, celebrate the life, don't mourn the death. But these actually were doing that, and it had been there for centuries. A different way of looking at life. Empathizing, not on curing, but caring for what was going on. And so sometimes when you look at people who are in difficulty, the ladder is that different way of looking at life, the wisdom, the different perceptions which you can have, which means you can be with somebody. And you can go right down into what they're feeling and feel what's happening in, say, France, with all the people who are really suffering very terribly with fear, with loss, the shock of young people with no sickness at all, prime of their life, now no longer alive. So what are you going to do with that? You can feel it, but instead of just trying to think something's wrong here, we've got to fix this up. That particular way just makes more problems in my ideas, my experience. Care. Caring, being wise, number one, is part of life. These things happen. We care enough for ourselves and for others. Not to try and solve the problem, but to care for everybody involved. And you'll find that these problems will happen less and less. Unless, if you empathize with the pain and stay with the pain instead of with something more positive, you too will start getting angry. You too will start getting negative. You too will start to look for revenge, as I'm sure that many people in France are now trying to do, to burn down a mosque or blow up somebody else, take revenge, what they're doing to our culture, whatever. So, in your life, whenever there is any problems there, difficulties in your life or in others, don't just get down into that pit and just suffer with other people without the ladder. Sometimes people think that's a marvellous thing to do. And sometimes people look at Ajahn Brahm and say, you're too callous. It's not callous. You can feel the pain. But also, you know how to get out and take other people with you. It's too much pain. Too much anger, too much seeking for revenge, and it just creates too much more violence and pain in this world. There has to be another way. And this other way of not just going for empathy, but just going for care instead. The real compassion, as I think one monk said in this article, not to feel with the other person, but to feel for the other person. Feeling with is just another person who is hurting. Feeling for is understanding and taking them out, giving them another way, and other opportunity. So quite often, I make a point in some of the saddest funerals I've ever been to. And you know, one of the saddest funerals which I've ever been to, the saddest loss, it was a Chinese girl, mainland China. She had a scholarship to study here in Australia. She finally graduated. And this was only child. This was one child policy in China at the time. Her parents had sacrificed everything for their kid. Made sure she got the best education. Sacrificed so much. Managed to get her a scholarship to come to Australia. And she, graduating ceremony, managed to get some funds together so her mum and dad could see her graduation ceremony. And with her mum and dad, who couldn't speak a word of English, she was walking, I think she was staying in Gosnells, walking down the road in Gosnells, and a drunk lost control of the car and slammed into her and killed her in front of her two parents. Killed her dead. And I had to do the funeral service, and the two parents because the whole world was, you wouldn't call it, it was confused. What had happened? The kid had done nothing wrong, just walking down the road on the pavement, the sidewalk, and just the drunk driver had done this. And it was sad, but I remember I had a choice. I could actually show rage, which many people would do. This was just so hurtful, so meaningless. So why do you do that? Just getting drunk, having a good time, but it's so dangerous, what can happen? And this is a case where it did happen, and you saw the results of it. But instead, do it to show care instead of rage. You can't cure, but you can always care. And that care was something which was palpable, which can actually show to those grieving parents who couldn't understand a word of English, at least they could understand care. Something which they could feel, and something which could start the process of coming out from that very deep hole of despair and confusion, which is what mostly I saw in their face, into a life after their daughter's death. A purposeful, meaningful life. So sometimes the empathy, when it's not used with wisdom and compassion, can cause huge amounts of problems. So for you in your life, in your workplace, in your friendship, your social life, there's going to be people who have a lot of problems and troubles in life. Sometimes that's going to be you, sometimes that's going to be your friends. Please, care for them. Don't always try and solve their problems. Care for them. And don't always say, that's a terrible thing which has happened to you. Sometimes I've had the guts to say, you're so lucky that that's happened to you. So wonderful that you've had that experience. And they're right in the middle of it. And sometimes I'm sure that many people feel like hitting me. What do you know? How can you say that? But I'm looking at it at a different angle. Trying to use, instead of empathy, and just being part of their pain, being the way out from their pain. Showing a route, a way. Because in our modern world, we do need that desperately. There's too many people going around saying, oh, isn't that terrible? Isn't that disgusting? Isn't that awful? That is not the right type of empathy. That just creates more pain and trouble. Instead, yeah, let's care for one another. Let's see if we can find a way out. Let's care for everybody. Different way of empathy. And in particular, your own situation. If you're trying to improve yourself, you know this by now, it's endless and you just get depressed and tired. Instead, care for yourself. See a bigger picture. And then you'll find some peace in your life. Oh, did I tell any jokes today? One. Okay. Because somebody reminded me earlier of some of the kids, of my duck joke. Do you want a duck joke? Okay. Two ducks swimming in a pond. And one duck said, quack. And the other duck said, I was going to say that. Okay. If anyone wants to commit suicide, probably now's the time, after a bad joke like that. Okay. So that was just trying to experiment with just real life and how we can use caring, not curing, and real empathy with wisdom and compassion, rather than just getting straight in there and becoming another problem. Okay, so any questions or comments about this evening's talk? There is on the internet? It wasn't working tonight. Okay, very good. So questions from overseas, first of all. Very good. Here we go. The first question is from a duck. Someone just quacked a minute ago. First of all, from Hungary, from France, Great. I'll do the French one first of all. I live in France, and 84 people from Marseille, I think the attack happened in Nice. I live in France, and 84 people, including some children, were slaughtered last night here. If I did not join in the mourning, people around me would be offended. They don't believe in reincarnation here. How can I feel serene and not mourn? Okay, please go. My advice, and if you want to follow, it's up to you, obviously, is actually to go to the events which are going to be happening there. But show some sympathy, but also just show that they can destroy people, but they cannot destroy the incredible French joie de vivre and égalité, fraternity, liberté, which is the slogan, the symbol of French culture. So again, if you are sad, too sad, which is you're empathizing with other people, you're not showing a different way for those people who are surrounding you. You can be somber without being sad. You can be kind without needing to cry. You can be the shoulder which other people cry on, rather than another set of tears which is looking for a shoulder. You know, you can be just a way out to people who are very confused. So it's not just going around laughing. That would be totally inappropriate. But you don't need to mourn. That will not offend people. To be peaceful, to be somber, to be serious, but also not to go too deep into that pit yourself. And then you can offer another way for other people when they see that you're peaceful rather than crying. So it's not feeling serene. You can feel people's pain, but also feel that there is more to life than just that pain. There's more to people's days than just that one night. From Hungary, when I try to teach or help others, sometimes I find myself trying to fix them instead so I can have an easier life, not seeing them suffering, and end up making them feel guilty. What should I do? Sometimes we say we don't like to see them suffering. In other words, we are trying to put them out of our suffering. And sometimes that we don't like to see people suffering, that's our problem. So it's up to us to understand that suffering is part of life, it's part of the learning, growing process. And sometimes it's like a parent with their child. You don't want to see your child hurting. So sometimes you are too protective of your children. You don't want to see them cut and bruised and crying. But that's part of the life which we have to allow our kids to get hurt, to get sometimes infected, to get cut, to get bruised, because that's part of the growing process. We don't like it, but we have to have that. And it's the same when you see other people suffering. Please, what you really are focusing on is your own suffering, not allowing other people to suffer. So we understand that we want to sort of ease their suffering, if at all possible, but please don't take away their suffering. Actually to take that suffering into a learning process, into a growing process, so the people, all of our friends, can learn and grow. Suffering is part of life. If we take it away from everybody, there'll be no growth and no compassion. And again, it does make them feel guilty, because when we don't allow suffering, when it's wrong to suffer, as I mention very often, when it's wrong to be sick, then people feel guilty when they get sick. Which is why I keep telling people, you all know this, when you go and see the doctor and you've got flu or you've got something, some sickness, what should you say? There's something right with me, doctor. I'm sick again. To take away the stigmatism and with it the guilt of being sick. So when things go wrong in life, they don't go wrong in life. You have a problem in your relationship. there's something wrong with my relationship. No, there's something right with your relationship. It's normal. It's part of the course. You're having an argument, having a difficult time. That is where you're going to learn from. That's where your relationship is going to be made, in the difficulties. So never say there's something wrong with my relationship when things are difficult. The problems are right. So you don't feel guilty. And lastly, from Canada, what's the best way to respond when someone disapproves of your peace, when they are angry? This happened to me. Wipe that peace off your face. Again, sometimes that what they see as your peace is like arrogance, because they're very angry. But just hold the peace, but make sure the peace comes with a lot of kindness. Because sometimes people get offended by peace, but it's very hard to get offended by kindness. So the kindness is, I think, what people can feel. The peace may be just a bit confronting, but the kindness is what they can feel. I think that will soften them. So they may disapprove of your peace, so add the extra kindness there, the softness. And I find it's just too hard to disapprove of it. Any questions from people here?
Ajahn, it's not a question, it's a comment. A very recent example of the positive aspect of empathy in this very Buddhist society. For the flood and landslide victims of Sri Lanka, the group got together and raised over $4,000. And that sort of thing, I suppose, is caring, which makes you happy, and you have done something to the those victims.
There's always something you can do. But again, basically, it's the last thing which a person needs, and maybe what they want is just, to hold them in your hand and just start crying with them. But instead of actually holding them in hand and crying, just start to build them a new home instead. So sometimes the so-called empathy can actually mean that the two people are disempowered, that we know we can't be active anymore. So sometimes that empathy just goes in the wrong direction. And of course, it creates too much anger as well. Why do these poor people have to live in these places with no flood control? We get angry at governments, we get angry at all sorts of people. Sometimes people get angry at a supreme being. Why does this happen to us? We get angry at other governments, we blame somebody or other. That's, where all this militancy and extremism is coming from. Just anger, blame. And again, it's empathizing with some of their brothers and sisters for their pain. That's where that's coming from. That's where empathy leads to. Empathy, again, in the hospital wards. It ends to anger. That's not the way this world needs to go. So I was trying to point out another opportunity, another possibility. So empathy, when it's not balanced with compassion and wisdom, especially with care, always to cure the problem instead of caring for the problem. I think that's one of the reasons why there was this attack in Nice. Why there is many problems in our world. Why there's much anger. It's not helping at all. Something for everyone to think about. For 3 months until I come back again.
Thank you.
Da da da. Okay. So, three sadhus. Sadhu. Sadhu! Sadhu! Very good. Okay. And again, I wish you all a happy time. I'll be at Bodhinyana Monastery for 3 months. You can always come and visit over there. And if you're really, really, really crying out for a Dhamma talk, there's hundreds on the internet. So you won't go dry. So let's pay respects to Buddha Dhamma Sangha now. Oh.